Today I would like to tell you the story of one of the most heroic American civil servants, of whom you probably have never heard. I'm going to tell you the amazing story of a man named Elijah Washburn, and if we can put him up on the screen, there he is. I want to tell you his story because in some very important ways that I want to underline, it's also your story and my story, and I hope to make that clear as we go forward. Elihu Benjamin Washburn, was born in 1816 in Livermore, Maine, and he had a very hard childhood. His father was a failed businessman, he contracted debts, and Elihu had to work through much of his youth to pay off those debts. All summer long, he worked from dawn to dusk, digging stumps, driving oxen to the plow, cutting and putting up hay, for which he was paid $5 a month. Easy to understand why he left home at age 17 to try his luck at something else. He tried different jobs before deciding at age 20 to study law, which he did. A friend and mentor helped pay his way through Harvard, after which he passed the bar. And then he moved to Illinois, which at the time was the frontier. That was about as far west as civilization went in the United States in those days. And there was a great demand for lawyers. Americans have always enjoyed suing each other, and so there was a great demand for lawyers there. He established a very good reputation as a hard worker and a competent man. So in 1852, he was elected to Congress. While serving in Washington, he became friends with another Illinois lawyer, a certain Abraham Lincoln. And a few years after that, he became an acquaintance of a junior officer in the Army named Ulysses S. Grant. When Lincoln ran for office, Washburn campaigned for him, and when Lincoln was elected, he became a close advisor to the president. He would often go to the front. We think fake news is a modern invention. There was a lot of fake news during the Civil War. Sometimes he would send the president, Abraham Lincoln, would send Elihu Washburn to the front and say, "Tell me what's really going on. I'm getting all these conflicting reports. I don't know what's going on. Go and find out for me." And so he would do that. And he would often visit his friend General Grant during the latter part of the war. During the Grant administration in 1869, Elihu Washburn was appointed ambassador to France, where he arrived in May of that year. There was a lot of griping and sniping about Washburn being appointed ambassador to France. He was just some guy off the frontier, come from a poor family, no great polish. You know, he didn't know all the manners and all the things that go along with society, and France was the most cultured country in the world at the time. They looked at him as a country bumpkin, and they said, "How is this fellow going to represent the United States?" But Grant had a lot of confidence in him, and so off he went. Of international travel, he said when he arrived in France, "My great enjoyment of being abroad is to be away from home and out of the incessant turmoil, strife, and labor and excitement of political life." He thought he was going to France for a break. He didn't know he was going to live through one of the worst periods of French history. You see, for several years prior to this time, in Prussia, which is the part of Germany surrounding Berlin, Prince Otto von Bismarck had been maneuvering to convince all the German principalities to unite under the rule of the King of Prussia. There was no Germany in those days. There were just a lot of German-speaking principalities, each with their own prince or royalty, and Bismarck wanted to get them all together under his prince. And he decided that the best way to do that was to provoke a war with France and win. Because if he could provoke a war where France would declare war on Prussia, that would scare all of the other principalities. And if in addition to that, little Prussia could beat France, this great power, then everybody would want to be on the winning side. So he thought they would all join together. So the Franco-Prussian War, the French were goaded into declaring war on Prussia, and they declared war on July 15th, 1870. So this is just about 5 years after the end of the American Civil War. So the fighting, the uniforms, the weapons were actually quite similar to what the United States knew. The French emperor was named Napoleon III. He was a nephew of Napoleon Bonaparte, the great general and emperor of France. And he led a very badly organized and equipped French army to the front. You can probably figure out how this is going to end already. He led them to the border, the German border, what is today the German border, where the Prussian army, led by Wilhelm I, was waiting or preparing to advance. Wilhelm was the first professional soldier to sit on the throne of Prussia since Frederick the Great. As the war began, all the ambassadors of the great powers left Paris for safety, except the American ambassador. He was informed by the U.S. President and the Secretary of State that he was free to leave. He didn't need to stay there. It was likely to get dangerous. But he wrote at this time, "This is my place where duty calls me, and here I must remain. This is my place where duty calls me, and here I must remain." Certain careers, certain callings, certain commitments require people to stay at their post, even in difficult and dangerous circumstances. And what I'm here to tell you today, brethren, is that Christianity is such a calling. True Christianity is a calling that requires us to stay at our posts, even in difficult and dangerous circumstances. Philippians chapter 2, verse 14 talks about this. Let's turn there and read it. Philippians chapter 2, verse 14. Philippians chapter 2, verse 14. Paul wrote to the brethren in Philippi, "Do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that I may rejoice in the day of Christ that I have not run in vain or labored in vain." That's our post, brethren. That's been the post of our predecessors in the faith, to be children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. The first century world was crooked and perverse. Our 21st century world is crooked and perverse. We're speedily heading in the same direction as the world of Rome. We're becoming just as debased as they were. That's our calling. That's our Christian post. It's never been easy, ever since the first century, to be a Christian, to swim against the tide. But based on the prophecies we have in the Bible, we know it's going to get more difficult in the years ahead as we move toward the return of Christ and the end of what Galatians 1 verse 4 calls this present evil age. We do live in a present evil age. I first gave this message at the Winter Family Weekend some months ago, and part of it was inspired by the theme of the Winter Family Weekend, which was armor up. That's a reference to the armor of God that we need to wear every day as we leave our homes. And we read about that armor in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10. Let's look at that. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10. And I'm going to read from verse 10 to verse 20. And I'll go back and underline a few of the items or a few of the terms that are used here and see what we should glean from this. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10. "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand, therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith, with which you may be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints. And for me, that utterance may be given to me, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains, that in it I may speak boldly as I ought to speak." A couple of things I would like to underscore here. I know this is a passage we've all read many times, but I'd like to call our attention to a couple of details. It says we need to put on the whole armor of God. We can't just pick and choose between the elements that seem useful to us. We really need it all. A soldier, a Roman soldier, would never have thought about going into battle and just, you know, I think I'll just wear my leg greaves today. I'm not going to worry about the breastplate. They wanted everything on. They needed to be protected everywhere, and so do we. Verse 12 talks about the wiles of the devil. Satan is wily. He is malevolent and tricky, and he is a merciless adversary. There's no pity in him. He'll never feel sorry for us and leave us alone because we're going through a bad time. On the contrary, that's the time he most likes to attack, when we're weakened by something. Verse 13 talks about standing in the evil day. There are evil days that will come on all of us from time to time. We might call them crunch times, crucial moments, turning points, times of dire trial, when our preparations will be plumbed and measured. We're going to find out just how well prepared we are. There are going to come evil days. And then verse 18 says, be watchful to this end with all perseverance. Perseverance. Sometimes in our Christian walk and life, the crucial quality will be perseverance. It will be hanging on, hanging in there. It will be a good kind of stubbornness, where we just tie a knot at the end of that rope and hang on. One of the lessons, in fact, several lessons that come from the parables, and one lesson in particular comes from several of Jesus' parables. I'm going to take the parable of the sower and the seeds, and we're going to see that one of the requirements to be able to succeed as a Christian is to persevere, to stay at one's post and do one's duty all the way to the end, however long it takes. Turn with me to Matthew 13, please. Matthew 13. Starting in verse 1. Matthew 13, verse 1. On the same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat by the sea. And great multitudes were gathered together to him, so that he got into a boat and sat, and the whole multitude stood on the shore. That's the first century version of a sound system. They didn't have a microphone and speakers, but he could go out in a boat, and by raising his voice a little bit, it would echo off the water, and many, many people could hear his words. So that's why he did that. Then he spoke many things to them in parables. Here's one of them. He said, behold, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seed fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured them. Some fell on stony places where they did not have much earth, and they immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. Some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked them, but others fell on good ground and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. We are so blessed to have ears that can hear. Infinitesimal minority of people on the earth today have ears that allow them to hear. And we are very blessed to be counted among that number, to be able to read these things and understand what the parables mean. Most people cannot. Turn over to let's move over to verse 18 now, and we'll hear the explanation of the parable. Therefore, hear the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is he who received seed by the wayside. But he who receives the seed in stony places, this is he who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. But he has no root in himself, but endures only for a while. For when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he stumbles. He endures only a little while, and as soon as a hardship comes along, he stumbles. He who receives seed among the thorns is he who hears the word, and cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful. But he who receives seed on the good ground is he who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and produces some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. One of the big keys that we see here, the keys to being successful as a Christian, is perseverance. staying at one's post. So my message for all of us today, the point of this sermon, is to encourage all of us to fix our minds and our spirits and to ask God's help regularly for the strength to do this, to fix our will to say, I will stand to my post, I will do my duty, come what may. In early 1871, Elihu Washburn, along with the rest of France and the rest of the world, was waiting for news of the war in Lorraine. In the 6 weeks after the outbreak of the war, Elihu Washburn had helped over 3,000 Americans leave Paris. You may or may not know that at this time, that was one of the best places to get an education in just about anything. Medical science, art, sculpture, any kind of science, really. France was still the cultural center of Western civilization. And there were many, many thousands of Americans who went to France to get their educations. He helped over 3,000 leave Paris safely. The mood of the city was full of anger and hatred for anyone who spoke German. You can understand that. So German workers, and there were many of those in Paris, were arrested. Some were accused of being spies. Some were shot. Others were imprisoned. And others still streamed to the American embassy for help because Ambassador Washburn was the only foreign ambassador who was still in the country. He had some pull to be able to get them out. The Prussian government asked Ambassador Washburn to help German speakers in the city to evacuate. They sent him the equivalent of $600,000 to help German-speaking people in Paris leave. So in addition to helping Americans, he began visiting prisons and trying to intervene to help innocent Germans get out of jail. He helped feed their families sometimes with monetary help while they were locked up. So by this point, now he was not only helping Americans leave Paris and France, but he was also helping thousands of mostly poor German refugees survive and get back home. The American legation in Paris helped 30,000 northern Germans leave Paris and get back home. They also set up an American mobile hospital, which they called the American Ambulance, but it was a mobile hospital, and it was the best equipped in the city, and they would treat anybody who needed treatment. So let me show you a few slides here now of what was going on. So this is the part of France where this war happened. This is an area where France borders with Germany. And one reason I know about this is that that was my pastorate for 6 years. This used to be, we pastored northeastern France, my wife and I, for 6 years, and I've traveled through these areas many, many times where this war happened. So the battle lines were drawn like this. There was a Prussian invasion across the border. This is an actual photo at the time. And on September 3rd, news finally arrived that the French army, one of the most advanced or believed to be one of the most advanced in the world, had been decisively defeated at the town of Sedan, and the emperor had been captured along with his army. There's a famous painting of, there actually was a meeting. Bismarck received Napoleon III, and they sat down and had a talk about the vagaries of war and how you can be on top one day and on the bottom the next. And so they had a discussion about that. And the emperor would go into exile just a short while after that. A new provisional Republican-type government was going to be installed in France. And, of course, the United States supports republics or democracies, so Washburn asked that the United States be the first to recognize the new French Republic. And the United States was the first country to recognize it. The thing is, though, that the new French government refused to surrender. They wanted to try to carry on the war. So the Prussian general von Moltke ordered nach Paris, the march on Paris. And Paris prepared for a siege. There were still walls around Paris at the time, actually quite impressive fortifications. So they marched on Paris. Herds of cattle and sheep were driven within the walls, along with all the other foodstuffs that they could bring in. Fortresses were stocked full of gunpowder and shells and everything that was needed to try to defend the city of Paris. And on September 17th, the Prussian army arrived and surrounded Paris, and the siege began. It was going to last 4.5 months, and Elihu Washburn was going to witness the whole thing. This is a drawing from the time of ambitious college students marching to the walls. They were going to defend Paris. The Germans would never pass. That's what they believed. There were daily artillery bombardments. Artillery like this. This is Prussian artillery that was on the outskirts of the city. And it did a great deal of damage within the city walls. But that wasn't the worst of it. The winter of 1870-71 was one of the coldest on record. The river Seine that flows through the center of Paris froze solid. And very soon all of the trees in the city were cut down for fuel. There simply wasn't enough fuel to keep warm. Parisians froze to death, some of them. Food stores ran low. Butchers that were originally selling beef, began selling horses. 65,000 horses, the main means of transportation in those days, 65,000 were butchered in Paris to provide food for the city. And when the horses ran out, they went to mules. And when the mules ran out, they went to dogs and cats. And when that ran short, there were certain butcher shops that specialized in serving rats. You can imagine under those circumstances, a lot of people became ill. Pneumonia, smallpox, cholera killed thousands of Parisians, as many as 4,000 a week, which was more than four times the normal. Normally about 1,000 people a week died in Paris, a city of that size, but now 4,000 a week were dying because of the conditions. Washburn negotiated with Bismarck to still allow any Americans who might be in Paris that who had stayed that long to leave the city. And Otto von Bismarck agreed. So Americans were still safe to leave. Finally, on January 28th, Paris couldn't stand it any longer, and an armistice was signed. France surrendered. The war was over. The Prussians retreated. They maneuvered their armies through the streets of Paris, a great victory parade, and then they left, but not before doing one last thing. In the great palace of Versailles, which some of you may have visited, if you've been to Paris, you probably went there. You may not know this, but the German Empire and Kaiser Wilhelm I, who was no longer just king but Kaiser, emperor, now they declared Kaiser Wilhelm I the emperor of the new German Empire. And they did that in the Palace of Versailles, not in Berlin. They did it in Paris after this great victory that they had. You can understand why there was some bad blood between Germany and France. There already had been because of Napoleon Bonaparte. He's really the one that kind of started it in the modern era. This was the German revenge, and then the French got revenge in World War I, and then World War II, and on it went. Many, many people died as a result of this. And that German Empire, of course, we know what kind of havoc it wreaked on the world over the next 75 years. But finally, the Prussians left. But though they couldn't imagine it yet, the troubles of Paris and of Elijah Washburn were far from over. They were far from over. And I'll tell you that story in a few minutes. What Elihu Washburn needed to do was not hard to understand. He needed to help Americans get out of Paris. He tried to help some innocent Germans get out of Paris and France. He needed to maintain a positive relationship between himself and his host country, as an ambassador should. That's what they're expected to do. And he actually did all of those things. It was not hard to understand what his mission was, but it was very hard to accomplish because of the circumstances, because of what was going on around him, because of external conditions, and sometimes even opposition from self-interested or fearful people. He had to battle all of that. Christianity is not hard to understand either, is it? Pretty simple. You can sum it up in 10 commandments. If we were to ask your children, your young children here, what is Christianity? What's God's way of life? They could probably give a pretty good account of what we're supposed to do. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Obey God first. Keep his word. Christianity is not hard to understand. But it's sometimes, I would even say often, difficult to apply because of what's going on around us, because of the people with whom we have to deal, because of world conditions. Ecclesiastes 12, verses 13 and 14, you'll recognize it when I read it to you. It says, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is man's all." That's all you have to do. Fear God, keep his commandments. "For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil." Learn to do God's will. Easy to understand. But I believe we're seeing, if you're watching the news at all and seeing some of the social changes that are happening in this nation, we see more and more clearly that living as Christians is going to bring pressure on us and opposition, even hatred. When I was a boy, I would never have thought that I would be hated one day for being a Christian, because everybody was a Christian of one sort or another, at least everybody I knew, and that was a very respected thing. When I was a boy and I told people, they asked me, so what's your father do? He's a pastor. Oh, that was a very positive thing. Not always the reaction we get anymore. Not always that. So we need to be prepared for that, so that we will be able to stand to our posts and do our Christian duty, come what may. In Matthew 10, just a couple of pages back, Jesus warned his disciples about this. This wasn't something unexpected, although it sometimes surprises us, even though we know it's written in the Bible, when it happens. Wow, why is that happening to me? Well, it's prophesied in the Bible. We shouldn't be surprised, but sometimes we're still surprised. I am. Matthew chapter 10, verse 16. Behold, Jesus said to his disciples, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues, and you will be brought before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak, for it will be given to you in that hour what you should speak. For it is not you who speaks, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Now brother will deliver a brother to death, and a father his child. And children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved. Persevere. Stay at your post. Endure. When they persecute you in this city, flee to another. For assuredly, I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It's enough for a disciple that he be like his teacher, and a servant like his master. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more will they call those of his household? Therefore, do not fear them, for there is nothing covered that will not be revealed, and hidden that will not be made known. And whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light, and what you hear in the ear, preach in the housetops. And do not fear those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin? And not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. Therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him I will also confess before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, him I will also deny before my Father is in heaven. My Father who is in heaven. What does that mean in verse 32? That he will confess people, confess his younger brothers and sisters before their Father who's in heaven. I don't think the Bible describes that exactly. You can imagine it as you wish. The way I imagine this is some sort of roll call at some point, where each faithful Christian is honored by Jesus Christ for what they did. And he'll confess their names. Maybe he'll say something like, Father, I know you know them. You know their names. You know all about them. But I want to introduce to you, I want to present to you officially this person, this Christian, because they were faithful and loyal to you under very difficult circumstances. Wouldn't that be amazing to have an experience like that? That's what it says to me. Whoever confesses me before men, I will confess before my Father who's in heaven. That would be amazing. But whoever denies me, whoever abandons his post, I will also deny before my Father who's in heaven. So do not think that I come to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. He who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake will find it. That's a pretty direct warning about some of the things that are coming down the pike, as we say. Some of the things that are going to happen in the future prophecies lay this all out. There will be persecution and tribulation. So the question we all need to ask ourselves, and I would submit we do this from time to time, will we leave our posts? Is there something that could make me leave my post? Something that somebody would do or say that would make me run away? Will we abandon our duty? We must not. To this we are called, to stand to our post and do our Christian duty. Together we're throwing out Christian lifelines to all those in the world who will hear it. And God will save some from the crisis to come through the message the church preaches. Maybe it will be by our examples that God will turn the light on in someone's mind, make them want to know more, make them want to come. Examples, the lights we shine. We each have a responsibility. Some parts of our responsibility are the same for everybody. Some parts of our individual responsibility may differ from Christian to Christian. We all have slightly different roles to play in the body of Christ. That's for God to decide. He's the one that decides what our particular role is. But each of us are entrusted with a charge to carry out, with a load to bear. And the Bible actually uses that term. Turn to Galatians chapter 6, please. Galatians chapter 6, starting in verse 3. Galatians chapter 6, starting in verse 3. For if anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But let each one examine his own work, and then he will have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another, for each one shall bear his own load. You have a load to bear. I have a load to bear. In some ways, those loads resemble each other. In some ways, they're slightly different. God attributes those things to different people according to their abilities and the gifts that he has given. Each one shall bear his own load. On the other hand, sometimes we have the chance to help each other. We can bear each other's burdens also. Go back to verse 2. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. So we each bear our own load. Sometimes we have the opportunity to bear a brother or a sister's burden as well. And we should look for opportunities to do that. The image that comes to my mind when I read this is from the movie Lord of the Rings at the end, when Frodo and Sam are climbing the last stretch up of Mount Doom, and Frodo falters. His load is just so heavy. And Frodo says, I can't do it, Sam. I can't go any farther. And Sam says, come on, Mr. Frodo. I can't carry it for you, but I can carry you and it as well. So you get up. Come on, Sam will give you a ride. You just tell me where to go, and I'll go. Maybe we'll have an opportunity to bear someone else's burden at a crucial time. What a gift that would be. And of course, we've read, we're of the value of many, many sparrows. He'll never leave us or forsake us. And all of these difficulties that may come in the future will be in God's hands the whole time. He's promised never to leave us. He'll intervene and watch and strengthen and protect in order to accomplish his perfect will through his children, each and every one of us. And what an honor that is, to be counted among the number of his children. Ultimately, the greatest danger to Elihu Washburn and to many Parisians was not the Prussians, it was other Parisians. After the French government signed the armistice with the Prussian army, the government was too weak to immediately send law enforcement into Paris. The army had been defeated. They didn't have any troops to send in. And local groups of radical National Guards, as they were called, with what we would today call, they didn't necessarily call it exactly those terms at the time, they would have what we think of today as communist sympathies. They took over parts of Paris. They emptied the armories and armed themselves and armed others who felt as they did. It's kind of like some of the things we're seeing in the United States today, where groups arm themselves and they take over certain sections of the city and they declare it an autonomous zone, and they're following the same sort of game plan. We've seen it before. They're declaring independent zones. But finally, all of Paris were taken over by these forces, and they declared Paris a commune. And that's the way this period of time is known today, the Paris Commune. Most Americans don't know anything about it. That seemed rather obscure to us, but it was one of the bloodiest and worst periods in all of French history. The activists were called communards, and they declared Paris a commune independent of France. It was no longer part of France. It was an independent city. And the legal French government fled to Versailles, which is just about 20 miles outside of Paris, and they used the Palace of Versailles as the seat of government. In Paris, mobs of people murdered government officials. Barricades went up around the city. Paris always had cobblestone streets. There's still cobblestones in some part of Paris even today. It's easy to dig those up and pile them up and make obstacles, barricades, so that other people can't come in. On March 22nd, an unarmed, peaceful group of citizens protested the violence that was going on in front of the headquarters of the National Guard. And the communard commander orders his troops to open fire. 30 unarmed people were shot down in the street in cold blood. They consciously patterned themselves after the reign of terror of the French Revolution of 1789. That you probably have heard of, the guillotine and all of the things that went along with that. It was a new reign of terror. Once again, Elihu Washburn could have left. He had a pass that allowed him to pass in and out of the city. He could go to the official government of France at Versailles and come back in again. He could have stayed outside. He didn't have to stay in the middle of that wasp nest, but he did, for the same reason he gave before. This is my post, and I must stay here. There were still some Americans in the city who needed help and protection. The ambulance was still operating. The mobile hospital was still operating. There was much need for that. Because the communards were looting the city, they took hostages to keep government troops from attacking. One of the hostages was the Catholic Archbishop of Paris. Innocent man, they just held him because he meant something to the people on the outside. Washburn intervened and asked for his release. And because he did that, certain communards said that he himself should be arrested and shot. And there was some danger of that happening. But he stayed at his post. And eventually, the Archbishop was murdered by firing squad. This is some of the damage that came to Paris, not because of the Prussian siege. This is the result after the communards and their fighting and the destruction of it. This is the roof of the Palace of the Tuileries, which is part of the Louvre complex. Now, if you've been to the Louvre Museum in Paris, the town hall was burned and looted, and a number of hostages were shot against the wall. That was the environment in which Elihu Washburn stayed. One of the darkest periods of French history, and our American ambassador stayed at his post and did his duty throughout. Finally, government troops broke through and took the city back, and there was hand-to-hand fighting before the last of the commune was finally crushed, and the last group of them were lined up and shot at a firing squad against a wall in one of the Parisian cemeteries. I've seen the wall. It's interesting to note in passing that Karl Marx and Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, better known as Lenin, and all other communists studied the Paris Commune, and they said, this is the blueprint of how we're going to do it, except we're going to be better prepared, we'll follow through with it, and we'll keep power. And that is what happened in Russia. That's what happened in the Soviet Union. They studied the Paris Commune closely because they wanted to emulate it down to the violence. If that was required, they're prepared to do it. Even today, when parties on the left side of the political spectrum have rallies in France, in Paris, a lot of times they'll end up in front of this wall because they venerate the communards. They think they're good guys. They're good guys. The greatest threat to Paris and to Elihu Washburn was certain other Parisians. And they're also, brethren, there's a parallel for us. Because one of the greatest dangers to Christians in the future will be Christians who will have abandoned their post and abandoned their duty. Turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, starting in verse 3. Some people had started the rumor that Christ had already come and he was hidden somewhere. The disciples in the first century had to deal with that heresy a number of times. But one of the proofs that Paul gave here that no, it hasn't come yet because there's something that has to happen first. That's what he's saying here. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God, claiming to be God. It's falling away. Now, there have been falling aways in the past. We've even probably witnessed that, some of us, in our own lifetime. People who were with the truth, were faithful in the church for many years, and then one day, because of some upheaval in the church, they threw in the towel. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going back. I'm going fishing, as the disciples once said. But this is talking about a falling away in the time of the man of sin who's revealed. That's the false prophet in the time of the end. So this is an end time prophecy. There's going to be a falling away of church brethren at the time of the end. He's going to be doing miracles. If you read about the false prophet, he can call fire down from heaven. I mean, there are a lot of pretty physically very impressive things, and he'll try to lead people away from the truth of the Bible. And for some, it's going to work. It's going to work. Matthew 24, verse 9, talks about this in a slightly different way. Matthew 24, verse 9. Matthew 24, 9 says, "Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved." The only way I can really understand these verses here is talking about people who knew the truth, obeyed the truth for a while, and then they become offended by something. Maybe something in the world. The world is becoming highly offensive. There could be a lot of pressure put on people who won't accept whatever the prevailing social idiocy is that's going on out there. And they will betray one another. And some will even hate one another. We've had glimpses of that, I think, in our history, where church brethren, former church brethren, can reach that point. The love of many will grow cold. That means you had to have had the love to start with. I think this is talking about Christians, former Christians, who abandon their post and abandon their duty. A falling away. As I said, that's happened in part, no doubt, but certainly not all of it. That kind of betrayal and tribulation hasn't appeared yet, but it will. And one of the greatest dangers to Christians in the future will be Christians who abandon their post and abandon their duty. We must not let that happen to us. We don't want to be among that number. You know, there are a lot of zombie movies out there. Let's shift gears and talk about zombies for a moment. A lot of zombie movies out there. I don't recommend them. But you probably know how they work because it's become a huge part of our culture nowadays, right? So you know what it is. The zombies, they're undead. And we don't know exactly how the whole thing started, but it started with something. And, you know, they walk around, and what they want to do is eat your brains. Okay, I didn't make the thing up, right? And they're relatively easy to kill, although they're already dead, but take them out of action. If you can cut their heads off, you're safe. And if there's just one of them, that's not too hard. But if they swarm you, that's trouble. And you know what happens if a zombie bites you, right? You turn into a zombie. And from being someone who fights the zombies and tries to protect your loved ones, you turn into one who's trying to kill your loved ones. Don't become a zombie Christian. Let's not any of us become zombie Christians who switch sides and go over and start hating those that we once loved. That's part of our commitment to stay at our post and do our duty. standing to our post and doing our duty means more than just saving our own lives. It might mean saving other people's lives and the lives of our loved ones. Christians will abandon their post, and they won't just die, they'll join forces with evil. We must not let that happen to us. So as I said, the importance of standing your post and doing your duty goes beyond your own life, or for me it goes beyond my life. It's a way of protecting our brethren from what we could become. Zombie Christians, un-Christians, Christian killers. It's going to happen to some, so let's resolve that it will not happen to us. There's quite an interesting prophecy about the Messiah in Isaiah chapter 50. Turn there with me if you would. Isaiah chapter 50, verse 4. Isaiah chapter 50, verse 4. The Lord God has given me the tongue of the learned, that I should know how to speak, a word in season to him who is weary. He awakens me morning by morning. He awakens my ear to hear as the learned. The Lord God has opened my ear, and I was not rebellious, nor did I turn back. I gave my back to those who struck me, and my cheeks to those who plucked out the beard. Now, you men who used to shave the old-fashioned way, you know what it's like to pull a whisker out, right? Snag one. Ooh, boy, that really hurts. Why would somebody come up to you and pull a whisker out of your beard or your mustache? There's no reason to do that other than just cause gratuitous pain. They just want to torture you. And apparently that happened to Jesus Christ. That was one of the things they did to him. I gave my back to those who struck me and my cheeks to those who plucked out the beard, and I did not hide my face from shame and spitting. For the Lord God will help me. Therefore, I will not be disgraced. Therefore, look at this, I have set my face like a flint. I know that I will not be ashamed. Jesus Christ set his face like a flint, one of the hardest of stones. Use flint and steel to make a fire because it creates sparks. That's how hard it is. He set his face like a flint. We need to set our faces like flints. We will not yield to Satan and his way. We will not compromise with our post or our duty. So I believe we should ask God to strengthen our will, because none of us of ourselves have the strength to do that. But God promises to give us the strength we need, so they will never abandon our post or give up on our duty. When Paris was finally liberated, Elihu Washburn was regarded, and rightly so, as a hero on both sides of the Atlantic, in fact, in all the Western world. Otto von Bismarck sent him a letter thanking him for all he had done. The letter said this in part, "His Majesty has commanded me to convey to Your Excellency the grateful acknowledgement for the zeal and kindness that you have devoted to the interest of the German residents under circumstances of extreme difficulty and with corresponding sacrifices of time and personal comfort." Newspapers praised him as well. One American newspaper wrote, "Paris was deserted by the titled and the great. It witnessed starvation and death and all matter of disaster. Mr. Washburn still remained at his post, throwing himself between the ranks of arrayed Frenchmen, fighting in a horrible death struggle, saving all that he could save." The New York Tribune wrote, "We do not recall an instance in our diplomacy of a more brilliant and successful performance of duty in circumstances of such gravity and delicacy." Not bad for a bumpkin, huh? Quite a man. His assistant for the American legation wrote of him this, "Hasn't our minister in Paris done splendidly? By the use of common sense, a kindly, generous disposition, and a true appreciation of the right, he has, during the last year, brought more credit to our government and people at home than they can ever reward him for. His name is on every tongue, and I'm sure that he will not escape the fate of other honest men for whom thousands of boy babies have and will affectionately and admiringly be named." And there were a lot of Elihus in the years after that. Washburn was offered great honors by President Grant, but he turned them down. He said, just write me a letter, an official letter of thanks. He said he didn't want to become too famous. So he finished his time as a much beloved ambassador of France, and then he resigned his post at the end of Grant's presidency. As I said, possibly one of the bravest and most exemplary American civil servants that you've never heard of before. The reason we know this story is that his journal came to light just about 12 or 15 years ago. They knew that he had kept a journal, but it was lost, and then it was found in the Library of Congress, and it's been published. So if you'd like to learn more about this story, I found it really amazing. It's a quick read and a fascinating one. So just look up the journal of Elihu Washburn. The time ahead of us, brethren, is going to be challenging. But after that short, challenging period in the scale of eternity, there's going to come an eternal reward that we read about in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians 4. Second Corinthians 4, starting in verse 16. Second Corinthians 4:16. Therefore, we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing. As we get older, things don't work the way they used to. Yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, this is being written by a man who was stoned and whipped and shipwrecked and swamped in angry crowds and dragged before magistrates and imprisoned. He writes about our light affliction. How is that? How can he talk about our light affliction? Because it's just for a moment. That's the next phrase. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. There's no comparison. No comparison between what we're going to have to go through and the reward that comes afterwards. So that's what we need to keep our eyes on. John Kennedy once said, do not pray for easy lives. Pray to be stronger men. Speaking to a military audience. Don't pray for easy lives. Pray to be stronger men. I think we should all pray to be stronger Christians so that we can armor up as a key to spiritual strength, so that we can have the resolution and commitment that we will always stand to our post and do our duty, come what may.